Welcome back to Discursion. This is episode 10, and today we are talking about Uncut Gems, the 2019 crime film set in New York. Crazy, running around town, Adam Sandler caper, directed by the Safdie brothers. And I'm Stephen. We're joined by
Dominic. Oh, sorry, I wanted to let everyone know who I was.
That's important.
Yes.
And this is part of a sort of mini series that we're doing on contemporary noir and crime cinema. So you might have listened to episode 9, where we were talking about Under the Silver Lake, set in Los Angeles. And now we're going over to East Coast America, to New York. So how would you characterize this film, Dominic, in sort of genre terms? Because we're putting it under that kind of crime, contemporary crime category, but it's also quite a unique object.
It is. I'm not sure how I classify it. It has echoes of the gangster genre, I think, in some sense. I mean, it involves some gangsters, although Adam Sandler's character, you know, the protagonist, is not himself quite a gangster. He runs a jewelry shop in the, is it called the Diamond District? I think it's kind of Midtown Manhattan. This central plot of the film, you know, revolves around a series of events involving this black opal that the which is the sort of central object around which the whole plot resolves. But the film wants to let you know that, you know, this is not an unusual event in his life. It's perhaps unusual in quite how out of control everything gets, but it's just how he runs his life.
Which is to not really run it in any particular way at all. Because he's the manager of this store, but and he has what seems like quite a supportive staff. In fact, he's really close to his staff, and he has an affair with one of his staff members. So they kind of accept that as normal behavior, as a Howard Ratner quirk. But of course, to the outsider and to the people that kind of just drop by his store, he's absolutely infuriating. And you could argue that it's his sort of self-regard that leads to a tragic end. His sort of clappered view his gambling addiction and his obsession with shiny objects.
Yes, he clearly has a gambling addiction. But I think there's a sense in which what we were just saying before about how this film relates to what I take might be some kind of, you know, real life in this world, that the film's relation to that is quite similar to his relation to that, you know, within the film. So you get the sense that everybody is quite aware that things fall off the back of lorries, that there are certain things that it's just best for everyone's life if these questions are not asked. I mean, you know, he takes the black opal to have it auctioned at a, what's obviously a very reputable auction house, and they clearly know the kind of person that they're dealing with, and there's clearly a way of managing that. So, yeah, certain questions which are simply not asked, and things are left in their grey area for everybody's, you know, for the good of everybody's peace of mind and just being able to continue operating. But he pushes it that little bit too far, or that lot a bit too far. In terms of how other people react to him, I think the film does a really good job of giving that sense that he's only over the top in his world, for the other people in his world, by a matter of degree rather than a matter of kind. You know, if you had a film that had a character like this sort of being plunged into some sort of ordinary, you know, suburban middle of the road sort of bourgeois life, which you get hints of that with the passover scene, which is quite nice that he has to sort of operate those two worlds, but within those two worlds. But you know, he would seem a quite extraordinary character if he was if the whole film was about him, encountering what we could call, the quote unquote normal world. But in
Yes.
fact, it's the fact that his world operates at this pace of, nervous energy and sort of everyone is trying is getting one over on everyone else, but normally it happens that they do it to such a degree that everyone's doing it to everyone else, so it's more or less accepted. It's so everyone's is pushing those boundaries, and in a sense he's just not as good at it as other people, I
Yeah.
think, maybe. So yeah, there are scenes where he, where he goes into the pawn shop to pawn certain things, and the people working there, who obviously know him very well, ask him if he's okay. So there's a sense that things are, that they can sense that, things are going out of control. But of course, they don't go. They find nothing stranger that he wants to pawn some expensive object for a few days. Like that's normal.
Yeah. He's clearly successful to some extent. I mean, in terms of wealth, he lives in quite a nice house. There's a question as to how much of his wealth is inherited because his father is, it's quite a wealthy family that he's in. And actually some of that wealth that's created problems for the family, and one of the important characters in the film is chasing Howard Ratner, in order to get a debt paid. But this is maybe an exceptional moment in an exceptionally chaotic life, that things have just gotten out of control and gone a bit too far this time. You said it has elements of the gangster film, and I think you see that in a sort of mob violence. And in the kind of dialogue, the interactions that take place, threatening, there's a bit of a tribalism to it. But also, it has the curious quality of evoking the pace of a heist film, but without the structure of a heist film. So it's not that a well-executed plan is going very well and everything happens very quickly and very smoothly. And then there's maybe a minor disruption that's overcome. It's just a constant stealing, or sort of moving money from place to place, but none of the but none of you know so they have that sort of fast pace, but none of the structure that you would get with a heist film, where the plan is laid out in advance because the plan is improvised.
Although I think that's a nice point though, because I think from Howard Ratner, so from Adam Sandler's character's point of view, he thinks he is, for quite a lot of the film, he thinks he is in the middle of a successful heist. I mean, heist isn't quite the right word, but as I say, this particular gemstone, which the very beginning of the film is in Ethiopia, where you see it actually being found in the mine, and the sort of point is made about, there's a one of the miners is injured, and so it makes it sort of gestured towards the kind of geopolitics and the human cost of actually getting these things. But that's afterwards generally left in the background. But he emphasizes that it's taken him, the best part of 2 years to get this particular stone. And up until much later than it's obvious to everybody else, he thinks that his plan is going perfectly well, and it's just encountering a couple of minor hiccups, I think.
Yes, it's almost like he's saying, "Why am I having such a bad day? This isn't. This is. These are forces outside of my control."
So, having seen it in the cinema when it came out first, I watched it a couple of days ago, again in preparation to this. And yeah, I watched it with my wife, and I said to her, and she hadn't seen it before, and I said to her that it is exhausting, and she said afterwards that she'd been expecting it to be emotionally exhausting, but she hadn't realized quite that it how actually physically exhausting it would be. When I said exhausting, she'd taken it as a certain kind of sort of draining. But there is a I think it's right. It is physically exhausting. But yeah, how that's created, I think, is really interesting. But also how that relates to his character, because he is, in most respects, a deeply unsympathetic character, and the film doesn't, I think, try and it very skillfully avoids all sorts of cheap tricks. I think that it could use both for raising tension and for generating pathos. There are all sorts of other things it could have done, which I think it entirely successfully sort of avoids doing. It might seem that the senses in which the character is utterly unsympathetic would then reduce our empathy, but for me, it didn't in the slightest. Excuse the cat. For me, it didn't in the slightest. I don't know. What do you think about that aspect of it?
Well, I agree first of all with what you and Kate said that it is an exhausting experience, and there's a field of research that suggests that cinema, although the stimuli are audiovisual, that it is a sensory experience in the sense of a physical, experience. And this film is good proof that cinema can alternate your breathing pattern and give you an aching back from, sitting too tightly in your chair. And some of that, a lot of that is derived from the fact that this character is just insatiable in his addiction and is seemingly unaware of the sort of violence that might come at the end of that, although he receives several threats, through the film. And I think a lot of the sympathy for that character comes from the fact that he is a farcical character, that he's very unaware. And so he's quite fun to watch in that way, although he may be very irritating and exhausting.
I suppose what I mean is that why does, yeah, so there's that. So there might be sort of other reasons for watching it than because you like him. Although I think the film does sort of give you an understanding of him, which, yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want to meet him in real life, but it's not quite so simple as saying that. I mean, he is detestable, but he is quite sort of human. Again, that's sort of what I meant earlier about the way the film avoids the some of the cheaper strategies it could have used to achieve those things. He could have been, if this character was, I don't know, if I'm going to be unkind, but if this were a Steven Spielberg film and he was played by Tom Hanks, he would have some sort of humanizing quirk. I mean, he does. He has his fish in his fish tank when he's upset when someone does something nasty to the fish, but that's not really terribly important. It's sort of he doesn't really deserve sympathy. He needs professional help, but he doesn't deserve to, but I think you're right, actually. I mean, that's very interesting about those things that, yeah, some studies of cinema have said about the ways that film, we relate to films physically. But I think some of those studies, or at least comparable studies, or those carried out by sort of scholars with comparable mindsets, would tend to say that we have to have a certain degree of empathy for the character in order for the suspense and the tension to work. We have to care about them. And I think that this film, perhaps it doesn't invalidate, but it perhaps problematizes some of those ways of thinking, because I don't think it lessens the tension in the slightest to say that he really has it coming, and he's given the chance to get out. In fact, it almost seems the film attempts to kind of demonstrate that's not the case, because it builds up to a certain point, which really gives him the chance to draw a line under things, and he absolutely refuses to do so and has to place one more bet. And you see, all the characters around him are having the reaction that the audience is sort of having. It's like, so there's a sort of I think it's sort of inviting the audience to try and go, right, that's it. We've given him enough of our emotional energy. He doesn't merit it. Let's just cut him loose. And you sort of can't, you know, the end of the film is still, it just ratchets up the tension even more. So, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
How about this as an Adam Sandler movie? The Safdie brothers have started recently to use more well-known actors. So they had Robert Pattinson in their previous film, Good Time, and now they have another big star. So how does this sort of compare to his previous roles? I mean, I suppose if you wanted to be very vague, you could say he's always played a quirky character or a comedic role, and so there's that, of course. But it feels like he's never had that darkness that you have in this film. There are similarities with Punch Drunk Love because he's a businessman and he's dysfunctional and he doesn't quite know how to relate to other people in some ways. But in Punch Drunk Love, the naivety is somehow cute in a way that it isn't in in Uncut Gems.
Yeah, I think it would be very, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Definitely that, you know, Barry in Punch Drunk Love is the closest comparison. And I think, you know, the best film that Adam Sandler's been in other than this probably. Although I say that as not an expert in Adam Sandler films.
I think we can guess.
But I think I think in fact you could do a really interesting study of those two characters, because I think they do, yeah, that they do take advantage of certain things in him as an actor, which are quite similar. I think there are all sorts of parallels, but the two characters, like you say, are also extremely different. There's the sort of, you know, there's the vulnerability and self-pity, but the sort of tendency or the propensity to violence, or at least to, you know, to losing it. Yeah, there's a certain pitch of tension, which even though Punch Drunk Love is not anything like as tense a film as this film, just as far as the characters go, I think there's that sense of instability and, you know, sort of walking on eggshells. You know, around both of them, and both of them also are kind of are put upon by their families. You know, in Punch Drunk Love, I think sort of much less deservedly. In this film, deservedly, but nonetheless, that's still he kind of brings out a certain sort of male, you know, sort of self-pity, sort of mopishness, quite effectively, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, and both of them are sort of, both characters have that sense of just being at one or maybe more than one remove from reality, you know, but. And obviously has a different sort of ending, and in this film it's ultimately predictably becomes entirely self-destructive, whereas in Punch Drunk Love it's, you know, rather beautifully done as a rom-com. He just needs to find someone else who's as weird as he is. But I think both characters, you know, I think that he's something that he does quite well, that it is related to the self-pity but makes it much more interesting, that both characters just don't quite get how the world works, and they're both quite baffled by how the world works. And when they think they've mastered it, they're sort of proven wrong, you know. Does
Yeah,
that make sense? Do you
yeah, it
think? Yeah.
is. I think that was a very eloquent comparison, and that we're finding there's a surprising amount in common between Adam Sandler's, sinister jeweler and some of his earlier naive, comedic roles. I wonder if this is also a good mid to late career performance in the sense that he is physically aged, and so that romantic role that you see in Punch Drunk Love with two young lovers isn't quite working. And he, is this his, you know, what Clint Eastwood did in Dirty Harry? Is it that kind of the outsider, sort of slightly sort of haggard, weary kind of look at the world? You know,
I mean, there's also good stuff done with makeup. His teeth are fantastic in this film. Like, his teeth are clearly expensive but awful. Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's judged very well. I mean it's not, yeah, I think lots of other people have said this, it's a sort of obvious thing to say, but it does just make you wish he, you know, chose to be in many more films by intelligent and interesting directors that were trying to do something more ambitious than, you know, his other films. Because it, yeah, I for all that we talked about, you know, there's similarities in what are probably his two most interesting roles. I don't get the sense, as you might with, I don't know who, but you might get the sense of a sort of a fairly limited actor who in the right hands can be deployed very effectively. I think like both those films show that he really has really quite a lot to offer, and it'd be quite interesting to see, you know, like I don't get the sense from, if you just, if you'd only seen those two films, like I think there's no reason to imagine that he'd have any less range than someone else, you know, than, I don't know, a Jack Nicholson or something, right? Than another actor who has a lot of similarities, you know, in all their performances, but nonetheless sort of puts them to extremely diverse uses. So yeah, I don't know, here's hoping that he'll choose to do more.
Yeah, well, it looks like he does have range in this film, and that he's, it's always difficult to know, isn't it, how much freedom is being given to actors in films like these, because you think about all the overlapping dialogue and the antics and the sort of physical gestures, how much of that is planned in advance, you know? You think of maybe Altman's films, or a lot of that dialogue is scripted and really carefully timed and recorded. So how much of this is Sandler enjoying himself being an independent spirit on the set, and how much of it is the Safdie brothers' son emolding him? Probably a bit of both, but...
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Although I have to say, what strikes me is also, I think, is one of the things which I think is very impressive, is that it's a disciplined performance as well, I think. Like, I think that's probably, it was enjoyable to play, but perhaps not, you know, uniformly. I don't know. I mean, who knows? That's pure speculation. But it's not, you know, as much as I love him, I'm a big fan, but it's not a Nicolas Cage style performance at all. I don't, you know, it's not an actor sort of losing it and that being used to express the film. It is an actor playing a man who's losing it, but I don't think Adam Sandler loses it, you know, at all. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, that could also sound like I mean it's slightly too sort of controlled. Like, I don't mean that, but I think it's the acting and the filmmaking seem to me to be very, I don't know, this is very hard thing to put into words, but my inclination would be, if I had to guess, would be that it's more scripted and more choreographed and more planned and rehearsed than one might think, rather than less so. You know, I don't get the sense of sort of an actor having built a character and then being sort of let free, you know, sort of free to let rip, and then, you know, the cinematographer just sort of desperately trying to catch up, and then them sort of editing together a film from the best bits. You know, it seems it's more like an Abel Ferrara film or something. And I think it sort of actually expresses chaos and can give the sense, perhaps in times, of a certain lack of form. But I think actually that lack of form is entirely conscious from a filmmaking point of view, and is kind of expressive of the character rather than actually being a lack of form, you know.
Although these films are a million miles apart, I'm reminded of teaching neorealist cinema to students and thinking of The Bicycle Thieves, just because there's kind of a theft in that as well. But it's about trying to explain how the film gives the impression of spontaneity or lack of structure, which can
And
be
that's a
very
really
difficult
nice,
to teach.
yes, and I'm sure, difficult to achieve in a film, without seeming contrived, without it being obvious that's what you're trying to do. I think, I mean, it's on the surface, it's, I mean, this in a good way, it seems like a ludicrous comparison, but I think with the to compare Uncut Gems with Bicycle Thieves, I think that's really interesting. There's a similar, there is something, a sort of spiraling sense of a loss of control, and one moment of what at least is seen by the character, and some could reasonably seen as bad luck, has these sort of cascading consequences which lead into others, which will, yeah, I mean, that's the last film I would have thought I'm related to this from. I think it's
Yes,
actually
me
really
too,
interesting. Well,
because
no.
Bicycle Thieves is highlighting a very serious issue of impoverishment and social inequality, whereas Uncut Gems is more about the what happens when you're trying to make too much money, what happens when famous basketball players obsessed with gems get involved. And there's a kind of pseudo argument in there about the exploitation of minors, but it doesn't go very far. Gives the film
No.
a kind of semi-religious sort of edge in the amount of sort of the aura that this gem has, and how it might be a bit of a cursed object in some ways, almost like an Indiana Jones kind of treasure.
But again, I think it's really skillfully integrated with the views of the characters because, Kevin, what's he called? Kevin Garnett?
Garnett,
Yeah, Kevin Garnett, the
who's
basketball
a
player, he plays
real.
himself. Yes. So that's quite nice. So it's set in 2012, so they have real footage when he was still playing, and he's obviously, 7 years older, but he plays himself in 2012 very effectively, I think. So he believes that the gem is has sort of good luck for him, and it's never explicitly raised, I don't think, that Howard comes to think that it's cursed, but yeah, that notion that it's cursed, that absolutely sort of plays through there, but it's, I think, interestingly managed by the fact that it's not just it's not imposed sort of symbolism.
Yeah.
It's also something which the character, himself could, I think, at some level also believes, which is often, I think, a good way of making that kind of thing
Have you
work.
seen the Netflix series? And I'm reminded this film is funded by Netflix. Have you seen the Netflix series The Last Dance?
No.
So this is a new Netflix series about the Chicago Bulls, really centering on Michael Jordan, but also paying some attention to Dennis Rodman, and his teammates. And it does talk about some of the rituals that basketball players have. Michael Jordan once played a game in his old 1980s Nike shoes, which led him to have bleeding feet on the court, but he had worn them as a kind of totemic thing. And so it just this film I think resonates with that. I just wanted to mention it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I know, yeah, I don't know about basketball, but I know cricket is a incredibly superstitious, so it's I think it's, yes, it's not unique to basketball either, I think. That's
Shall we watch a sequence from the film?
yes.
I've got it loaded up here. So you chose this one, Dominic. Do you want to tell me what's happening in it before we
Yeah,
start?
so this is about halfway, yeah, almost, I think exactly halfway through the film. So for, yeah, sort of starting at 1 hour and 5 minutes. And this is a scene in Howard's jewellery shop, which is sort of centering around the fact that the door, so all these jewellery shops, they're all inside these, Manhattan high rises. So they have an out an outer door. There's something about them not having it. They feel windowless. I mean, in fact, his office at the back has a window because that's one of the explicit allusions to gangster cinema when he is literally hung out the window by his feet. But nonetheless, the shop itself sort of has no windows, and the fact that the door has no glass in the front door, there's that gives it a certain particular sort of claustrophobia, I think, which I think you don't quite kind of explicitly register. Anyway, but the door, you have to buzz on the outside door, and that there's a camera so the staff can see who it is and then buzz you in. And then when you're buzzed in, you can't enter the main shop because there's almost like an airlock. So you have to wait till the outer door closes, and then they can release the inner door. And there's a plot point that the inner door sometimes jams, the magnet doesn't work, and this becomes crucial later in the film. But this particular scene is the first moment where we are introduced to this and see it happening. And I think just also a nice example of a sort of moment of the film of sort of maximum chaos with about nine things happening at once. So I just thought it would be good to look at an example of that, because it feels like in one's memory the whole film is like this scene, although in fact of course it isn't. But yeah.
Great, let's get to it. Hello.
Hello.
Oh.
It's amazing. Up until they, yeah, so from the moment just before Kevin Garnett and his entourage arrive, until they, and then the door sticks until they get released. It's 3 minutes. It feels like about, I mean, in a good way, it feels like about half
Yeah, it's
an
agonizing, isn't it? I don't know what's most irritating about that sequence. For me, actually, noticing this time, he's offered at that point £175,000, dollars for the gem. And
Yeah.
that's exactly the amount that Kevin Garnett will later bid at an auction and
Yeah.
subsequently try to give to Howard in return for the gem. And he
Well,
does give it to
although,
him. But
no,
this
I think
is a
that.
moment in the film where he could have taken that, and then maybe it would have been happily ever after.
I think the film alludes to that, but I think actually it's even more. I think there's a couple more wrinkles than that, because I think when Garnett does buy the gem, he says that, because Garnett, buys it for 175, and he says, like, what was the point of all this? But in fact, he bids at the auction, Garnett bids 190,000. So had Howard not got his, there's an older family member who he gets to force up the bidding. So had he not had him go all the way to 200,000, because he was thinking that he could get, had he not just had that little bit of greed, he would have got 15 grand more. So I think it's things like that, they're little things that make it sort of plausible how his life sort of operates, that thing about just that one little bit more. It's just that he can't sort of distinguish between, he just can't play the game very well. He doesn't know when to stop, so there's a sense in which, yeah, of almost of Howard as a failed gangster. I mean, he's not literally trying to be an actual gangster as some other characters in the film are, but because the clip we just watched starts with him on the phone to Kevin Garnett's agent, because he's desperate because Garnett hasn't given him back the opal, and he's trying to get tough, which just completely fails to work. And just irritates the agent, and is clearly going nowhere, at which point they turn up anyway, so it was all pointless. So there's that sense of him as a almost some kind of failed gangster. Or those moments when he thinks that he's deliberately pushing things too far to get something, they come to nothing. And then the other moments when he shouldn't push things, he does push, so he pushes when he shouldn't and he doesn't when he should, and he just messes it all up,
It's a great sequence, this. The sequences does have cuts and close-ups, but there are also several long takes which take you in and out of the office, and so there's that notion of really drawing out the back and forth of trying to get this door open, which makes the 3 minute sequence feel like an hour long. Which is not representative of the whole film. The whole film, although 2 hours and 15 minutes flies by, for me, I suppose it's the emotional time versus actual time
Yes,
disparity.
exactly. Or if you're watching this sequence, it almost feels to me like it's quite maybe quite cleverly gives the impression of using longer takes than it actually does. I don't know. I mean, we'd have to watch the whole film to think about, it's it's editing and things, but it uses sort of, so it uses in that bit we just watched quite noticeable sort of handheld kind of whip pans, you know, from one, I mean, it's a small shot, but there's quite a few moments where it's, you know, very visibly pans from one side to the other, almost giving the impression of a, you know, that sort of fly on the wall documentary kind of thing, of sort of catching up, you know, with the action. And I think you almost notice that, and then, or at least for me, you know, being caught up in the situation, you then don't notice that actually lots of even a short scene like this is actually being constructed on pretty classical shot, reverse shot, and actually relatively short takes, but not short takes which are short enough to create tension through sort of montage. Actually, they tend to not draw attention to themselves. I think it gives you more of a sense of being, you know, the memory you're left with is sort of being stuck in the room with those people.
Yeah.
What's the next one?
What's the next one? Well, funny you should ask. Next time we'll be doing Burning, the Chang Dong-li Korean film of 2018, which has been called a noir film, although a lot of it takes place in you know, not in the sort of locales that we usually expect a noir film to take place in, and has an interesting theme of the new middle class. So I really look forward to talking about that with you. Until then, do subscribe. We are on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, we are on Spotify and also Podbean, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Discursion Film. Thanks very much for listening. We'll see you next time.
Thank
Bye.
you.